Hi, everybody. We really hope you enjoy this next episode. We absolutely love doing them. We're trying to grow this community, and we're trying to spread the word, and you're a big part of that. So if we could ask that if you go to wherever you get your podcasts, and if you're not already doing so, follow the show and share it with all your network, that would be much appreciated. Secondly, if you'd like to write us a review, that really helps to get us noticed and move us up the league tables of the podcasts and spread that word. Lastly, we really wanted to thank you for all of your feedback, all of you that have taken the time to reach out to us, either with pointers of where we can improve, suggestions of who we could interview, or just give us words of encouragement. It's really very much appreciated. Thank you so much, and please keep it coming. And lastly, just wanted to say thank you so much for listening. We love doing these podcasts, and hopefully you enjoy them too. Hello and welcome to the NRG podcast, The Horse That Asked Why, and other stories. So welcome to the latest episode of the NRG podcast, The Horse That Asked Why, and other stories. Another fantastic guest. Can't believe that we're getting to speak to some phenomenal, phenomenal people. But before we introduce the guest, Glenn, I think you've had a pretty wet and windy day, but
yes,
Ross Ainslie on the Ainslie Saddlery jolly up around the US. What's going on?
Fellas, I think I might be in the coolest room I've ever seen. There's Western saddles upside down tied onto the rafters. The chandelier above the pool table is a wagon wheel. We've got a legend over in the corner checking out the photos, Memo Grasita. And this place is absolutely incredible, and I'm so honoured to be here in the saloon at Monty Roberts' house.
Wow.
Thanks very much, Roscoe. You completely ruined my introduction there. Well done.
No. Sorry, Nick May. It's a bit overwhelming, to be honest.
Bit overwhelming. So, yeah, it is completely overwhelming. So we are in the presence of a man who literally needs no introduction, described as one of the greatest horsemen of all time, Hollywood stuntman, Western rider, trainer to some of the most well-renowned and well-respected horse owners in the world, wrote the book, The Man Who Listens to Horses, who, when I realized that I knew even less about horses than I thought I did, that was the first book that I went to try and understand horses, and loved his approach to training without trauma and without violence. And that has been a key tenet which has stuck with me throughout. And Monty, you probably won't realize this, but you and I shared an employer. We both worked for the same... Yeah, we both worked for the same lady for quite some considerable time.
Was she as nice to you as she was to me?
Yeah. Well, she sent me to some interesting places, that's for sure. So I worked for Her Majesty the Queen for 16 years in the British military, and I got to visit all of the less well-known tourist attractions around the world with a lot of my heavily armed friends, and generally got to dig holes.
I see.
And wear a selection of hats. That was pretty much my career. But thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. We are absolutely in awe and delighted to be able to speak to you. We've got so many questions, but we wanted to start off with, I'd just love to hear your journey into horses and what drove you towards your approach to horsemanship?
Well, that's easy. I wasn't into horses at all until I was 4 years of age. And at that time, I was asked to go into a competition, which at 4 years of age, you're not sure what a competition is, but you try to do what they tell you to do. And I was on a very nice horse, and I was against kids that had only ridden a little bit. And so I was the winner of a trophy at 4 years of age. And the day after that, I was in Los Angeles being sold by my father to be a stunt person for films being made that needed a child to do stunts. And they were using dwarfs before me, and that didn't work so well. They didn't look like children. But it was against the law to do what I did, so they had armed guards around me. And my father held a gun at my first horse's ear and said, if I ever told anybody what I was doing, he would pull the trigger. And that will keep your mouth shut when you're a four-year-old that loves your first horse the way I did. He knew that was a certain way to have his way with me. And it went on from there. For 10 years, I was a stunt person on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, traveling on Friday, competing on Saturday and Sunday, and then traveling again on Monday to do more stunts. No elementary education whatsoever. I had a teacher on the road with me, and I had to go 2 days out of each month to take tests to show that I was getting an education. I didn't know there was anything unusual about this way of life because it was the only way of life that I knew. And I loved my horses, and I still love my horses. And I was teaching a course today, for instance, and one of the students said, really kind of break it down for me and tell me how to make a horse be gentle. And I thought for a second, didn't need much more than a second. And I said, it is impossible to make a horse be gentle. You cannot make a horse be gentle. You can cause a horse to be gentle, but the horse has to make the decision to be gentle because they're flight animals. And you can't make them do anything very well at all. And that's why whips and pain in the training process is not very effective. So causing the horse to want to do what you're asking is the key, not to make them do anything.
What was the sort of tipping point that made you realize that in your book you talk about, you know, the traditional training methods and then your decision to go in a different direction? What was it? Well, was there any one particular tipping point that did that, or was it a gradual process? And if so, what?
No, there was a tipping point. I was 15 after about 6 or 7 years of going out to help capture Mustangs for a wild horse race in the middle of California that was a popular thing at that day and time. And I was 3 days early for one of those trips, and I decided that I could cause, because I was taking care of Mustangs in the pens at home, I could cause a Mustang to want to be with me instead of away from me. Oh, that's kind of strange. And none of the guys that were, I'm 15, none of the guys around me thought this was a wise idea at all. But I went out and I branched a horse off, parted him off of the herd, and 3 days later rode him back to the ranch house. And they said, you're a liar. Somebody just broke this horse and turned him out. And then you found him and he was gentle and you rode him. Well, I should have said, I said, you should have seen him 3 days ago. He was as wild as he could be. Wouldn't you know that the queen said, she read about that, and we had conversations about that. And after the queen had me come and do her horses and then write the book, and that was her statement, there must be a book and you have to take it to the world. I want you in as many countries as you can possibly go to. And so I went for 33 years to 41 countries with these demonstrations. But she said, in the middle of it, at the time of the book, she said, is there anything you haven't done in your life that you wish you had done but didn't have a chance to do? And I couldn't think of anything. We were at Hartbury College in the middle of England. And I said, you know, I can't think of anything, but I tell you something I did do that nobody believes I did do because those guys didn't believe I rode that horse that I brought back out of the wild. And I caused join up with a Mustang in the wild. It was about 12 miles to the nearest fence. Wow. And she said, I want the BBC to do a documentary about this. And we will adopt from the government of the United States three Mustangs because they want a couple of backups. And we'll put them out with a herd of Mustangs and you go part one out and we'll have helicopters and we'll have motorcycles and steady cams. And we want to see this thing that you say you did, but nobody believes you did. And that's Shy Boy, the horse that came in from the wild. They brought me three horses. They brought them to me. I didn't see them. They kept them about 100 miles from me, put them with 100 other horses. And I went out and chose the one horse that they had told me they wanted to use. And I parted him away from the herd. And in 3 days, we rode him back to the ranch house. And it went as nothing else could have gone. He's 31 years old now. And Mustangs don't live past 15 or 16. But he's 31 years old, and it was a dream come true.
So, Monty, talk us through how you actually came to chatting with the Queen to start with and that journey.
Well, that was there is a God in heaven because there's too many miracles that happened here. And I had an open house here for trainers in California. And there were two journalists that came to this open house. And one was from Florida and one was from California, and they both wrote stories about what they had seen. Both of those magazines ended up on the Queen's desk, and she read them. And Owen was her first riding instructor, and he told her that violence wasn't necessary with horses, and she believed that, and she loved her horses, as you know. And she gave her two magazines to Sir John Miller, her equerry, and he took them home, brought them back the next day, threw them on her desk and said, it's hogwash. It's a complete phony deal. It's a lie. And she said, but one of these is from Florida and it's 3,000 miles over to California where the other one is from. Why did they both write the same story that they saw him doing horses that had never been done before? Well, I don't know, but it's phony. And she said, well, I'm buying you a ticket and I'm sending you to California and I want you to watch him. Sir John Miller came here. He watched me all one day and said, what are you doing in April? And I said, what do you want me to do in April? And he said, the Queen's going to want to see this. So she had 23 horses in front of her bedroom window in fields. I couldn't go near them. They had guards around me. When I first turned up there, Gorbachev was there with Raisa, and they herded us off about 20 miles to another house, and I had to stay away from the horses. And then we started doing the horses, and I did everything that I said I could do. And Sir John Miller saw what he saw in California the same way. There was no trick to it at all. And she was very angry at the reaction of some of the military people there. I don't know whether you know Corporal Major Terry Pendry or not, but Terry Pendry was equerry to the Queen for many years and still lives in North Lodge at Windsor. And Terry Pendry was certain that he figured it out, and he said that I had a way to tranquilize him with powder out of my pocket. And I've had every test that man could devise, and it's still up to the horses. They do what I ask them to do, and they do it in a way that nobody has ever seen before my time. And, I'm no genius. I have two doctorates in behavioral sciences now, but that's only because of what the horses have taught me. I'm no genius at all. It's just that I've learned the language of equus, and I use it, and they respond to it.
And so through your career, at what stage did you start competing in what disciplines, bringing your new philosophy of pain-free, fear-free training?
I was in competition at 4. And then they kept me in competition because on the weekends, I could bring more horses to my father for training, and I could bring more children to my father for his classes. That all happened in the 40s. And during Second World War, there weren't very many horse shows, but they were making a lot of movies with kids with the horses. And I was the stunt person in those. And on the weekend, in competition on horses.
What sort of competitions were they?
Show jumping.
All right.
Hunting, Tennessee walking horses, but mostly Western.
And Western's where you focused a lot of your energy going forward?
Western is where incidences took me. And I got some horses that were really good in the rein cow horse aspect and the cutting horse kind of thing. And so that's what pointed me in that direction was the horses. And I won 11 world championships and an amazing amount of horses went to memories that will never be taken away from the horse industry. Johnny Tivio won 4 world championships and they had 3. They canceled them after 3. Stallion sweepstakes where there it was 6 disciplines they had to act in, these Western horses. You had to rope a calf, you had to rope the heels, you had to rope the head, you had to cut the cow, you had to do the reining dry. And he won all 3 of them. And then they canceled it after that. And I won the world championship in horse mastership at Madison Square Garden in New York in 1950. I was 15 years old, and I was up against kids that were almost 18. You couldn't be 18. You had to be a little less than 18. And so I've done it all. Then I had more than 100 champions in thoroughbred racing.
What took you into thoroughbred racing?
What took me into thoroughbred racing was that I was showing these horses and everything, and a guy came to me that was Hastings Harcourt, Harcourt Brace and World Publishing. He was worth billions of dollars, and he had a psychological problem called up and down. What do you call that?
Bipolar.
Bipolar disease. And his father sent him to California and said, stay out there. We'll send you the money. But we're sick and tired of you going through your ups and downs. And so he said, I want the best horse farm in the world, and I want the best race horses in the world. So, boom, I'm into racing. And I went all over the world buying race horses and training race horses and putting them in various places where we won champions. 54 champions now in Germany alone. 54 champions of their division.
Wow. So talk us through your philosophy with racehorses as opposed to the general train of thought when you were entering into the racehorse industry.
Well, the starting of a racehorse is without any violence. And you know and I know that when you go around the world, the starting of racehorses generally has a lot of violence and a lot of whipping and riding them in a box stall with whips banging on them and stuff. And you can't make a horse run fast. You can't do it. You can't make a horse do anything. If I start them in a nonviolent way and get them to want to do what they're doing, they're flight animals already. They want to run fast. And so you let them run fast, but you control that and you wait for them to make up their minds how good they want to be. And you need a good horse. I mean, you can't make a good horse out of a bad horse, but the good horses have to be allowed to become good. They can't be forced to become good.
And through that process, we were just down in the round yard having a look at, because I've seen videos of Monty working with people and horses in the round yard. You were saying initially that round yard was built without a platform around the outside. It was actually built so no one could see in because you were getting a lot of
criticism.
Yeah.
For saying that I was starting these horses without any violence, and you know very well that he's beating them up. Those horses are just doing too well to not be beaten up. We just don't know what he's doing. So they tried to see me, and they tried to put me down and say, you know, he's lying to us and stuff like that. So I built these things with tongue and groove boards, 8 feet high. Nobody could see in. And Farrell W. Jones, who was one of the Hall of Fame trainers here in the United States, climbed up in a tree on my property. I was sending him babies and he was winning championships with them. And he climbed up in a tree and he could look over the 8 feet and see what I was doing. And that night at the dinner table, he said, "What the hell is it you're doing in there that caused these horses to come to you and cooperate with you and everything?" And I thought, oh, God, now what am I? He said, "I'm not going to tell a soul, but I want you to put a thing there, some bales of hay there." And I go up and I watch what happens. So I showed him. And then he and another trainer started to tell me, Charles Whittingham. And he said, "We need to have an open house here. And we need that open house to have these people come and really see what you do so that you can stop this criticism stuff." And they brought about 200 people and we built a ramp around there. But first ones were on bales of alfalfa hay around there. And I did these. And then after that, the articles were written and the Queen found it and it just went from there.
Wow. What about you've actually had quite a bit of adversity bringing this new method to life. You were saying you were kicked out of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, when my first book came out, I mentioned some guys that I thought were too vicious with horses to do very well, and they threw me out of 4 Halls of Fame. They were angry, and they threw out my best horse. And so I called the guy that was the chairman of the committee, and I said, "What have I done wrong? I retired 20 years before they threw me out of these halls of fame. In 96, they threw me out. I retired in 66. So what is it, 30 years,
30 years
later?" And they said, "You know, we were just angry, so we threw your horse out too." And I said, "But what did he do wrong? You can say I did something wrong if you want, but what did my horse do wrong to get thrown out? We'll put him back in." So now he has 2 certificates. They put him back in 20 years after the first certificate. They put him back in, but they didn't put me in. And I tell you straight right now, you can bet on it. They're waiting for me to die, and then they'll put me back in those halls of fame. But they can't stand it if they've made their living and their father was right about it and they used whips and they used force to train horses and felt they needed to. And I'm not saying brutal people necessarily. Some were brutal. But this horse that I won 4 world championships with was started by another guy, and he tied his head to his tail every Monday morning and knocked his neck down with a pipe that was filled with lead. Come on. You know, that's crazy. And as soon as I let that horse go and find his way without demand from the human being, he just went on and won championship after championship. So he's back in the Hall of Fame again.
Andy, I've read your book when I was young, and I thought it was amazing. And one thing that I have always been in awe of is your ability to get the message across to people.
Yeah,
you've got the horsemanship, but to be able to give that message to people and get that message across to people is a really rare trait. How did you develop that?
Well, I don't know. I got a good education, and Sister Agnes Patricia was one of my first teachers in grammar school, and I didn't go to grammar school, but I was there, and she saw bruises on me, and she went to my father, and she's one of them that took my side of this issue and got me away from my father. But she encouraged me to go and study behavioral sciences, the scientific department of a university, but behavioral sciences. Why do we do what we do? And in learning that, I learned how to put it over to people. And so I got my doctorates, and I taught people in Switzerland and in England and in other countries, quite a few other countries, including New Zealand. I did several courses in New Zealand for people. And I love to put my nonviolent ways over to people, let them try them and see how it works. It works for human to human as well, husbands and wives and bosses and people that work for them.
I've got a question. One thing that I find really hard to explain to people, we've got, you know, 60 to 80 horses in work in New Zealand all the time. So we're always limited by how many horses we can ride ourselves. So you always, as you would have had other people on the horses, so you're constantly actually educating people more than horses because you're trying to get them to do what you would be doing on them or something along that vein. When you're trying to explain to someone how to be firm, how to have soft hands, we call it, you know, like we call a rider that rides well to have soft hands, but it's not just soft. It's hands that don't take when they give and it's hands that don't give when they take. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that to someone and that the feel? And
well, the explanation of it is one thing, and that's human words trying to put a point across. The horses can explain it better than anybody. And you watch the horse and you say, go ahead, do this. Now do it this way. And the horse is better when you do it my way. And they learn pretty fast.
They learn the feel from the horse.
Yeah, they learn the feel from the horse. There's no better teacher about horsemanship than the horses themselves.
True. Nick, what can you take home from this for Glenn Gilmore, the horse?
The bit that I struggle with, Monty, is, you know, we mentioned at the beginning there that I'm from a military background, and the military is, in the nicest possible way, it's a very confrontational way of communicating. You know, we're used to giving a set of orders, and if you don't get the response that you want, there's a level of confrontation, and that confrontation escalates until there's either the application of some form of physical discomfort, or some form of punishment if the orders are not followed. So this is a continuation of, and it's underlining that might work in a military setup, but that mindset just fundamentally doesn't work when it comes to horses. So it is just a question of just being as kind as possible.
Well, here's the thing. We are predators. Mm-hmm. Yes, we can be amenable. We can be comfortable with one another. We can be softer or more difficult. But essentially, we lived because we were predators. The horses never, ever were predators. They don't eat meat. They don't try to run somebody down and kill them. They just don't do that. They're flight animals. And if we can get to be more like the horse when they're working with horses, instead of more like the human who is a predator, we can show them that the horse will respond to you better than if you're a predator coming after them to say, you do what I tell you to do or I'll hurt you. That's what a predator does. I might even kill you and eat you. Horses will go against that. They are positive thigmotaxis. It means they go into pressure, not away from pressure. They go into pressure, and we don't. We go away from pressure. If we touch a sharp object, we pull away from it. But we are thigmotaxic, positive thigmotaxic, in one place in our body. It's in our mouth. And if you think about children bringing in teeth and their gums are red and sore and they want to bite down on something hard, that's going into pressure.
Yeah.
And that's the only place we are positive thigmotaxis. The horses are absolutely away from pressure until there's something that hurts them and they go into it and fight it. That's how they've lived. Then they blast away. So if we can stop being picky and forceful, we can get along with a horse a lot better.
So your join up process is about getting that message across.
Exactly. When they say, I want to go away from you, go on away. Go away.
The question that I have, Monty, is I've heard you talk about join up a lot. I've read about it in your book and I've seen it a lot. But can you just articulate the principles of the join up process?
It's easy to do because think about the wild horse that I did in the wild. You want to go away? All wild horses want to go away from a human being. You want to go away? Go away. I'm just going to follow you. And as you get tired of going away, you're going to kind of turn back to me and say, what would happen if I came toward you? And you walk away. You leave, you walk away, and they'll take a step or two toward you. And then when they think they've got you going away, they'll turn and go away again, and you go after them again. In 24 hours.
It sounds like my wife.
That's the same thing. It's the same thing. And in 24 hours, with Shy Boy, for instance, I'm riding another horse and I go away and he follows me. And then he says, oh, when I get to the bottom of this canyon and I'm in these trees, I'm going to get the heck out of here. And I watch him closely. And when he goes away, I go after him again. Oh, hell. And in 24 hours, he was locked onto me and wouldn't go away. That means he has to go away some more. So he wouldn't go away, but I didn't hurt him for it. I walk away and he follows me. And, in another 6 or 8 hours, I had a halter on him and could lead him.
That's a seriously impressive feat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Monty, I've got a follow-on question before Ross jumps in again. The following question I've got is it sounds very trite, me saying, you know, I like to be as kind as possible. The horse that I've got is called Glenn Gilmore, very much like Glenn Gilmore on the show here. And he does challenge me, you know, and I still try and get on him and try and get a tune out of him. Have you had horses that have challenged that kindness, and how have you dealt with that?
You know, when you ask me about have I had horses, I mean, tens of thousands of horses I've had. Yes. So I've had every kind of personality you can think of. And I've had mean stallions that have attacked me.
How do you handle those?
Yeah.
Well, you handle them by staying out of any particular spot whereby they can corner vulnerable. You and you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
And then I've had them here where they couldn't stand the stallion because he's trying to kill everybody. And in 6 months, I'm rubbing them all over and they're perfectly happy with me because they know there's no challenge to them. And so you don't make a challenge, but you block. I built places where they couldn't get to me.
Yeah, right.
And then I had bar gates that would put them over so you could give them a bath or do their feet or do their teeth or whatever. And everything I did, no matter how angry they got, I was quiet with them and kind to them. And they give up on this business of being a killer. And each of those killers were made by people that made them killers. Horses don't want to just become killers for the sake of it. So I've had every kind. Don't think that I just happen to have champion after champion. I've had bad horses and good horses and down the middle most. So it's tens of thousands of horses that have taught me these things. And I just couldn't. I know I can teach people even more things to find than I learned. I'm the first person to do all of this. So it isn't going to be perfect. And I'm seeing people do some wonderful things.
How many books have you sold?
Books I've sold?
Yeah.
Well, there's 8 books, and I think one was 6.2 million. And after that, I don't know. It's
that's
probably
a lot. 10. That's a lot anyway.
Yeah, probably 10 million books. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. So I wonder how many people you've actually had an impact on and how many horses you've had an impact on. Probably one of the most influential people on the planet as far as horsemanship goes.
Well, it could be. The Queen thought I was, and it would be millions of horses that were influenced by me because of my students and stuff, millions of horses. But, you know, that doesn't make me any better than anybody else. It just simply makes me lucky enough to have gotten started by the right kind of people who kept me from being what my father was. I had 72 prepubescent fractures. Before I was 12 years old, my father broke 72 bones in my body. And I'm still paying the price for those kind of things. So I've learned both sides of this life that we live. And I like the side that I ended up with a lot better than the one I started out with. We had a hand up here.
Glenn Gilmore.
Yeah, two things, Monty. I was told that you fostered a lot of kids.
Oh, yeah, 40.
40?
Yeah, 40, how did, 40, 42, I think.
How does that come about?
Well, it came about after I married Pat. I liked kids, and I worked with a lot of youngsters as I was a stunt person with youngsters, working with youngsters. Pat was pregnant shortly after we were married, and we lived in a little place, and I had a few horses in training, and I was in university. And the people, I was doing work in this area of human relationships. And along comes the county of San Luis Obispo in California. And they said, we've got a little girl we want you to meet. She loves horses. And we know what you do with horses. And we know what you're doing with psychology. We'd like you to meet this little girl. And I went to meet the girl. It was only about 5 miles from my house. And she was in the field with a horse when I met her. And as I was out meeting her with the people that protect children, her mother came in with a customer. Her mother was a hooker. And she came in with a customer from a bar to a little trailer that she had her daughter and her living in. And she brought the guys to this trailer. Yuck. And they said, you know, she loves horses, and we're going to have to arrest her mother and take the trailer and this out of this property. And it was not her property. And we're going to have to put the child in a home somewhere.
Home, yeah.
Would you mind taking this child, because she loves horses so much? Pat came home from Northern California visiting some friends and found that she had an adopted child. And we raised this girl, and she was perfect. And she learned in school the things that we thought she should learn. She started a business. She did well with her life. And another one came along, and another one came along, and another one came along. And they started coming along that were born too early. And these doctors got the idea that these premature babies could be jockeys, potentially could be jockeys. So Larry Legue, they called him Slip Through Legue, he won 2,400 races as a jockey, and he was 7 months and a tiny little kid when he came to me. Never had been on a horse before, but learned to ride right here, and I put him off to the racetracks here in California, and it just went that way. It worked so well that we just couldn't stop doing it, I guess is what you would say.
That's incredible.
And sometimes we'd have three or four. We had an extra house here on the place, so we put them in that house. And then we had sons and daughters of our own, and they got to be like brothers and sisters to our own children. And they still come. They come and visit us just like we're grandparents now.
What an impact you've had on those lives.
Yeah, 47. It's 47 foster children. Yeah.
Wow. And you've still got people coming and learning. And I saw students down there today by the looks of it.
We have about 4 to 5 classes per month.
Oh, right.
With between 10 and, well, between 4 and 15 students per class that are coming from all over the world to learn the nonviolent way of training.
That's incredible. Good knowledge, Glenn Gilmore, by the way.
No, that's okay. Monty, I believe if my maths is right, you are 88, and you are incredible for me. I think it's amazing. Can you tell us about the Flag Is Up farms? Everywhere I read about you, the name of the farm, it's a very odd name. Where does it come from?
Well, it's not odd if you're in California and it's in the racing industry, because in California, they have to raise a flag. It was the law. It's no longer the law, but it was the law that a man would physically raise a flag in front of the starting gate. And the judges would watch the flag fall when the gates opened. And when the flag went up, all the horses were in the stalls that they were assigned to. And so that was the moment everybody was peering at the starting gate.
Okay.
And Mr. Harcourt said, let's call it Flag Is Up Farms. So that's
a great name. Now it makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
One more horsemanship question. What a lot of young people again come to our place to improve horsemanship and so forth. What would be the one thing you tell all the students that come through here? The first thing you try to make them aware of?
Nonviolent training is better than violent training.
Yeah. Sure. That's
the number one thing for me.
Just the philosophy straight off the bat.
Yeah, yeah. No hitting. I hit my last horse in 1949 at the demand of my father. I had to hit a horse. He said, you hit him now. And I hit him, and it didn't do any good. And that's the last time I've hit a horse. I have halters that do certain things that help horses learn how to come forward and go into places that they are frightened of and stuff like that. And I do things with plastic bags on a stick that you can get the same result as a whip times 10, shopping bags on a stick. We have riders that are non-human that we build. Artificial riders that go in the saddle before people do, and those riders don't hit them. They flop and they frighten them, but then they don't hurt them, so they're very quick to accept a rider like that. Yeah, everything is nonviolent.
Gentlemen, I'm aware of we've got two legends here. I don't want to hold up too much of their time. And they've been very, very, very kind to entertain us. Have you guys got any more questions? We might wrap it up.
I mean, probably got an hour's worth of questions.
Memo Grasita's got a question.
Oh,
Memo.
Hello.
Memo has a question.
I want to ask Monty his polo experience.
Yes.
When you play polo, Monty.
Yeah, I played polo. My father played some polo, and we had lots of polo mallets. And some of my bones were broken with polo mallets. I'm telling you the truth. And a lot of mallets were broken over my back, et cetera. But I played polo on the grounds at Salinas as a very young player. But I played with, who was the veterinarian that was the best polo player of his time?
Billy Linfoot.
I played with Billy Linfoot. And Linfoot, of course, was a superstar. But my thing was just to ride people off and get people out of the way. As a teenager, I was just a thug on the polo field, and I didn't hit the ball well. I didn't make scores.
Sounds like Ross.
I quit.
To be fair, it is a little bit like me.
I quit playing polo. I really quit at about age 16, 17, and I was bad. So, you know, and I didn't learn the aspects of polo that I should have learned. And off I went to these other disciplines. But I really admire top polo players. And boy, oh boy, I've had Adolfo Cambiaso here. I've had Memo and Carlos here. And they brought me horses and they brought me breakers, didn't they? They brought me breakers from Argentina. And they brought, Cambiaso put 20 horses in a field here that were greenish kind of horses that needed a lot of work. And then when he saw what they did, he sat down with me one day and he said, this is it for me. This is the way my horses are going to be started now, not broken, but started. From now on. And scientific studies were done from England that showed that they were killing 52% of the horses that they broke in Argentina and Chile and Peru and Venezuela. Yeah. They were killing 52% of the horses that they broke by roping them and tying them to that post in the middle.
Oh, killing them during the process.
During the break process.
Jeez, and, Louise.
Cambiasso told me a couple of years ago when he was here that since they changed to my way of starting their babies, they haven't killed one horse in the breaking process. And the difference means that now he's spending how much per young horse, where before, they just used the little Spanish horses and they cost very little. And now he's using... cloning them, and hundreds of thousands of dollars are going into them now because you know they're not going to die in the process of being broken.
Amazing,
Monty. It's really interesting to hear you say that, because I was looking at Adolfo's Instagram a couple of weeks ago, and he was had some footage of him doing his young horses in a round pen, with a lot of the stuff that you do. And I was wondering where he had got that from. So it's amazing to hear that story of, he's got that. That's phenomenal.
Wow. Let me tell you a quick story I think you'll find amusing. The next year, after the first year that he brought 8 breakers here, they came back to play again in Santa Barbara. And he brought some of the same guys by, and I can speak enough Spanish so that I get by with them a little bit, And they said, "We made an improvement on your system." And I thought, "Oh God,
hello,
what is this?" Yeah, here we go again, Yeah, we've thought of something that makes it better. I said, "What is that?" And they take an old retired polo pony that's not going to play anymore, and they put him with 22-year-olds over here, or 3-year-olds, I don't know. 2-year-olds over here. And then another old one and put with 20 over here, and another one put with 20 over there. Then when we bring them in for the join-up, they come in with their friend, the old horse.
Oh, in the round pen.
In the round pen.
They're like a nanny, yeah.
Yeah, and the old horse joins up immediately, and the young horses follow, and it is better.
Correct.
So I didn't make all of this myself.
It evolves,
and I've learned a lot from people like that. These were not stupid people that he brought me. They'd never been to school or anything, but they're bright guys that saw that the old way was not the best way. This is a better way.
What a cool way to make a difference. That's amazing, mate. Unbelievable. Monty, you've been on the face of the planet for 88 years. You've seen things, done things. If you had one place that you could go to tomorrow, where would you go?
Maybe I'd go fly fishing in New Zealand again. I don't know. I loved some of the things about fly fishing in New Zealand are just off the charts. Really wonderful. But I love my horses. I would go, to the big horse races. I would go to the major cuttings, world championship cuttings, and the all around things. I have 2 students of mine, now a father and a son, that have won the world's greatest horsemanship contest, which involves 6 different disciplines. And I would love to go and watch one of my students winning that kind of thing. There's a lot of places I would love to go, but I'm going to Brazil this next week, and I'm going to see, I guess they tell me, 40,000 people in one audience there for the world's championship in bull riding.
Yeah. Whoa.
So there's a different story for you.
Holy moly.
And now they want me to talk to them about treating the bulls properly that become really worth a lot of money as bulls that are almost impossible to ride. And they are better when they're not beaten up and treated badly. It's hard to treat a 1-ton bull very badly because he can really hurt you, but they're going to have me sit and watch what's happening in the chute before they go, and then say, no, 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 don't do that. Don't try to hurt them, and don't do this because they think you're going to hurt them, and that sort of thing. If you see now, Lemmy is his name, Jose Lemmy, using my techniques on how to get on a bull in the chute. And I rode some bulls, but I was not a bull rider at all. I rode some bulls as a teenager and got bucked off a lot. But the psychological act of bull riding is now becoming really something incredible. And getting on the bull properly and getting him out of the chute properly and allowing him to do his thing properly is making millions and millions and millions of dollars for people that never would have done that if they just stayed being vicious with the bulls, and the bulls will kill you. There's no question about it.
I did not know we were going to go down that path.
No, it's a path that you wouldn't think that I would be near.
Incredible.
But I'm near all things animal, and all things human too. You know, think about it. Why do you do this? Why do you do that? And what happens when you do this and that? A little thing like you're getting on a bull and they'll get their rope right. And then they do like this so that it gets tight in their hand. And the bull feels this on his back and then he jumps and then you got to stop and start over again. Or they take the end of the rope and flick it over and he sees that go over and he thinks that they're going to hurt him. And so he jumps again, and that's costing them millions of dollars. They have about a 15% increase in re-rides because of things that happen in the chute.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and think about that on TV where you lose 3 minutes here and 4 minutes there and 5 minutes there. I can help them with all those things.
That's incredible. Yeah.
So, Monty, I came to your place 20-something years ago. I was with Corky Linfoot, who was a very good friend of mine with the coaching Apollo. I really enjoy the way he does that. And I met Crawford Hall. You weren't there, unfortunately, on the day. And I met Crawford. He was a fascinating man to speak to. I just wanted to say that I went to your place. Unfortunately, I missed you.
Yeah, I roped with his father when I was a teenager in team roping.
Yeah.
Hall. Crawford Hall was made to be a quadriplegic by a horse falling with him out of the starting gates. And then I had him come here and work for me in a wheelchair where he could just run it between his fingers like this. He could get around the farm. But he became my barn foreman for 15 years, dead and gone now. But he had an extra 15 years in life because of what I did with him, I think. That's one of the great thoughts of my life. As I roped with his father in one of the largest rodeos in California several different years.
Monty, people that want to learn more about you and your methods, best ways to do that?
Well, I'm on the internet, and I never turned a computer on, so I don't know anything about them, but they tell me here, Pat does it, and our daughter. I've given the farm over now to our oldest child, which is our daughter. And they know if you go on MontyRoberts.com, you're going to see all the people that are there that are going to help you find ways to take courses or whatever it is that you want to do.
Brilliant.
Are you good on Instagram? Can you take a good selfie, Monty?
I don't have any idea what Instagram is.
Come on.
We had a bit of a challenge knowing if there was Wi-Fi in the house.
Yeah. I don't know.
You need to take a selfie, Ross, with Monty. Show him how it's done.
I'm going to do that right now.
Come on, let's see this. I want to see it. This is a selfie.
It's an ussy.
Oh, you're kidding me. I've just got Ross. Hang on, wait. I've got to get a photo of that. That is so good.
That is a Kodak moment right there.
Oh, God.
Monty, thank you. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. Amazing to speak to you. I mean, it's an absolute privilege. I've been a huge fan, as I say, for an incredibly long time, as I'm sure millions of people are around the world. So thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, it started out to be something I was doing for one of my favorite neighbors here, but he hasn't said a word through the whole thing. And Memo and Carlos, they are the reasons for Adolfo Cambiaso finding my place and knowing about my systems. And they brought their friends here. And my other neighbor on the other side of me, what is it?
Oh, Joel Baker.
Joel Baker. Yeah. He plays polo and has some polo horses. And his wife, Charlotte, was in the Olympics and in dressage. They're close friends. They're on each side of me, Memo over here and Baker's over there. And Carlos is sadly gone from our existence, but he was such a good guy. And when I was there with the Queen and Prince Philip ran and grabbed Carlos and threw his arms around him because apparently they played on the same team together several different times. And Carlos was a fantastic man. I met him in Florida when I was doing some demonstrations there. And it's just been a wonderful realization of what one discipline can do when you don't know anything about the discipline. Polo is just a million miles from anything that I did well in my life. I have world championship right up here in team roping and a world championship right up there in bulldogging. And then four world championships over there with the working cow horses. But there's not a trophy anywhere in this house for polo, believe me.
As opposed to the house I just left. I actually got a photo of the trophy wall in Memo's house. It is something else.
Yeah. And I just appreciate those guys so much. I wish I could play polo too, but there's just so much you can do with your life. Yeah.
So good.
Good to meet you all.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Monty, thank you so much.
Say hello to Norway for me.
I will do, Monty. Okay.
Yeah.
Every Norwegian, you got to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. Monty Roberts says hi. Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. We really hope that you enjoyed that episode. We absolutely love doing them. We're trying to grow this community, and we're trying to grow and we're trying to spread the word. And you're a big part of that. So if we could ask that if you go to wherever you get your podcasts, and if you're not already doing so, follow the show and share it with all your network, that would be much appreciated. Secondly, if you'd like to write us a review, that really helps to get us noticed and move us up the league tables of the podcasts and spread that word. Lastly, we really wanted to thank you for all of your feedback, all of you that have taken the time to reach out to us, either with pointers of where we can improve, suggestions of who we could interview, or just give us words of encouragement. It's really very much appreciated. Thank you so much, and please keep it coming. And lastly, just wanted to say thank you so much for listening. We love doing these podcasts, and hopefully you enjoy them too.